Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. If you're hiring, with Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/NPR podcast.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. A high school teacher leading an outnumbered squad of soldiers against the Nazis. An astronaut who brings a crippled craft back to Earth. An airline pilot who miraculously avoids disaster. Tom Hanks has a knack for seemingly ordinary and very decent men in extraordinary circumstances. His performances always land the plane. The two-time Academy Award winner has expanded his portfolio over the years to take in producing, directing, and now writing. His collection of fiction indulges his weakness for typewriters, but proves just as generous as his portrayals on screen. This hour on Point, we talk with Tom Hanks, his book, his work on the screen, and his perceptions of Hollywood. You can join us on air or online. What draws you to Tom Hanks? Do you see yourself in the characters he portrays? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and the Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Tom Hanks, actor, director, producer, and author. He has appeared in more than 70 films and TV shows, charming audiences with films like Big, Apollo 13, Castaway, and Saving Private Ryan. In addition to his work in Hollywood, he's written a collection of 17 textured and sympathetic short stories called Uncommon Type, now out in paperback. I have a copy right here. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Tom Hanks, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, David. That sounded very glamorous until you got to the typewriter stuff. Then it all just fell apart.
Yeah, I think you want to be able to get your geek on public radio. We're not ashamed. Well, you got to embrace it this morning.
Nothing better than retro technophile.
Well, and I promise, we'll get to that. But
you promise?
No, nice. Actually, I do. I really do. We keep our word here. If nothing else at On Point, we keep our word. First, I want to ask you, what made you dive into print? I mean, you've had a lot of success other places. Why do this?
Well, it's an extension of what I do down at the office. We all hang around in each other's doorways and talk about stories that intrigue us, that we've heard about, that have been fed by maybe a newspaper article or sometimes just something we saw on the way into work. And then we start debating what the best media is for that story. Not everything can be a motion picture or a multi-part series or even a TV series or a documentary. And they have just stacked up over, I guess, the better part of 35 years. Getting to the point where I've written screenplays a lot, and I've written on an awful lot of the projects that have come through the company that have made it to the air. And it was just an extension of a desire, really, that required no small amount of discipline. But these stories have all rattled around in my head, and they leaked out.
I'd like you in just a sec to do a reading for us. You must have had a ton of fun writing it. It seems as though it has to have been inspired somehow by what you do in your day job. The short story I have in mind is called A Junket in the City of Light. It's a little bit racy for public radio, but I'd love for you to read it to us.
All right. This is the story of an actor who finds himself promoting his movie worldwide. Irene took him to the media center on the 8th floor to sit through a total of 57 television interviews lasting no more than 6 minutes each, all held in the same room. Rory seated in the same chair with a one sheet of the movie behind him. In the poster, Willa was staring off into space, a look of ferocious concentration on her beautiful face, her torso clad in a tight sweater, a rip exposing her shoulder and the top sphere of her left breast. Behind her was a mosaic of images from the movie, an explosion, dark figures running in a tunnel, a massive cresting wave, and Rory wearing a headset and looking at a computer, serious as all hell. Willa Sachs is back as Cassandra Rampart, was printed in big letters. Rory's name was in the cluttered building block at the bottom of the poster, in typeface the same size as that of the film's editor. Irene kept him plied with green tea, protein bars, and small bowls of blueberries.
Rory, the actor in question is something, I think it's fair to say, of a lunkhead. What made you write this piece?
Well, mostly it was I come back from tours around the world in which you're really a messenger of commerce. At the same time, you're trying to make a connection with whoever you're talking to about the role you played, about the reason that you did the movie in the first place. But it ends up being sort of like this massive soul-sucking, self-loathing-producing version of, I think, of a political campaign in which you just reduce to hawking your wares, in which the demands of you start very early, and you end up doing things like giving 57 six-minute interviews in a row, all to people who are asking more or less the same sort of questions. And it requires a skill in order to get through it that can only be developed over time. I think, like Rory Thorpe himself, the first time I did this, no one coached me on how to survive one of these things. Uh-huh. No one said, this is going to be both mentally taxing and physically exhausting. Now go to it and make sure you say good things about the director.
And repeatedly.
Over and over and over and over again. I did a small piece for Entertainment Weekly that was just describing one stop in Singapore on what it's like to do a junket for a motion picture. And after a while, honestly, you no longer know the words that are coming out of your mouth. You're just saying sort of some combination of the talking points that the studio has given you and some version of telling just enough of the truth so that you're not just a big fat liar.
You know, in reading these stories here in Uncommon Type, I feel like a couple of things really surface. There's a fundamental decency that emerges time and again to people and they're thinking about one another. There's a nostalgia that's kind of leavened by pain, which itself is, I don't know, leavened by human connection. And there's also a real sense of place where there are just these very specific details. What do those do for you?
Well, I think the stories that I'm attracted to both as an actor and as a producer and certainly as a writer too are always about procedure and behavior. Conflict and jeopardy and relationships develop themselves in the midst of what all of these sagas are. But the procedure of how to live as either a 7-year-old boy who's suddenly living with a stepmother in the family, or of a World War II veteran in 1953 who's just trying to get through a Christmas Eve with his sanity intact, or four people that have been good friends for a while and they've known each other since high school. There is a rote performance. There is almost a protocol that goes into all of those circumstances. And in those, which I call procedure, in that procedure, along with the behavior of the people that go, there is a logic that is irrefutable. It doesn't have to be stated too loudly. If you do it right, everybody sort of knows the pace and the place and the tempo of everybody's thought processes. All of these end up being about human nature, human behavior, one way or the other. I think if you do it right, you can identify. You can ask yourself the question in every one of these stories: is what would I do if I was in that circumstance?
You follow a group of friends, and they appear, I think it's four times throughout the
I think only three.
Right?
I tried to do four, but
they talked you out of it?
No, I ran out of steam, I think. I had to turn everything in.
At one point, I think one of the characters says it's as though we're characters in a sitcom, that we've been cast, mm-hmm. an improbable sitcom. In one of them, you know, it starts out, and it's about how two of them hook up and get together in a relationship that's doomed because it's so frantic. But in one of them, they go to the moon. Is this a Tom Hanks? You know, it becomes a sort of very gentle sci-fi short story, which I didn't expect at all.
Well, that was the first short story I wrote, and it got picked up by The New Yorker against all sorts of odds. And I wrote it because, quite frankly, I wanted to go back to the moon. And I know enough about the ballistics and the physics and the requirements of doing it. Now, they don't land on the moon. That's a big deal. They just fly around and then come right home because Dave Scott, who walked on the moon, Apollo 15, when we were working on Apollo 13 years ago, and then later From the Earth to the Moon, this series that I wrote on and produced for HBO. He said, "Well, you know, Tom, it's pretty simple how to get to the moon." He said, "If you could throw a hammer far enough, well, it would just head to the moon, make a little figure eight around it, and come right back home." And that always stuck in my craw. And I thought, "Well, hey, let me write that and populate it with people who crack me up." And the end result was, hey, earlier you said it sounds like it was fun and easy. Oh, well, it was fun, but it was anything but easy. And there were sometimes I wanted to shoot myself in the foot just so I wouldn't have to continue.
You'd be sent back, no longer have to be in combat as a writer.
Yes.
You're obviously interested in space as an actor. It sounds like a real fascination to you.
Well, I think it comes from a sense of glamour and romance that was pumped into me when I was a kid. I mean, I grew up during we would watch the launches of the Gemini space program, and the getting to the moon and the space race against the communists was sort of an all disciplinary pursuit. There was science involved. There were economics involved. There was geopolitical strategy is involved. But for me, there was also just the romance of these two or three people who were just in this cramped little thing. I remember they always said the spacecraft was not much larger than a Volkswagen Bug. And my dad drove a Volkswagen Bug, so I would go out and sit in the parking structure at the Buena Vista Park Apartments in our Volkswagen, pretending I was an astronaut, knowing that spatially it was about the same ratio from me to the outside, and that was equal to the Greek myths or any sort of great saga that you could get out of science fiction.
And it seems like you were able to convey that excitement, at least for me as a viewer, on screen as well. Tom Hanks, stick around. We're talking with Tom Hanks about his book of stories, Uncommon Type. I'm going to stick around. We hope you, the listeners, stick around. You can join our conversation. What Tom Hanks characters stick with you? What do you like about his book? What have you always wanted to ask? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel Alarcón, host of NPR's Spanish language podcast, Radio Ambulante. We tell engaging, one-of-a-kind stories that give you a more nuanced sense of Latin America and the U.S. Latino community today. From events that are changing the political landscape to intimate stories about everyday people. Listen to Radio Ambulante on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik, and I'm talking this hour with Tom Hanks, an uncommonly well-regarded actor and colleague in Hollywood who often plays seemingly common men thrust into uncommon situations. He's also author of a book of short stories, Uncommon Type. You can join our conversation. Do you have a thing for typewriters like Tom Hanks? What's your model of choice? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm intending and hoping over the course of this hour you totally disabuse us of this, Tom Hanks, but people seem to think you're an awfully nice guy. I have a comment online from a listener named Lars. He says, when I was in college in New York, I had a couple of friends who walked up to the filming location for Big in hopes of seeing Hanks. They got his attention. He snuck them on set, talked with them for a little bit, let them take a photo, and saw them off. They were giddy for days, but also enamored with how down-to-earth he was. It's hard not to think about how badly that couldn't have gone. I think stars walk a tough line. We have a call from Neil in New Orleans, Louisiana. Neil, go ahead.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to say, out of all of Hanks's masterpieces, my absolute favorite is his Instagram account. I hope it's like real and it's yours, but just, I mean, I would like for Mr. Hanks himself to explain sort of the deal with it, but it's just incredible for anyone who hasn't seen it.
Thanks, Neil. Tom, are you having a team of pros doing that for you?
No, those are all mine. The only thing I do is I forward my post to a fellow in my office, and he posts it for me. Other than that, you're mentioning probably a lot of lost articles, things I see on the ground in my feet in a park somewhere. A lot of lost gloves, and each one seems to tell a little bit of a story. And I don't touch the items. I just come across them. I take a photograph of it, and I post it with some sort of verbal haiku to go along with the visual one that the picture represents, and I think it just dangles a story out there. Sometimes like little binkies, you know, little pacifiers. I always wonder if you look down, particularly in some busy cities like New York, there's a lot of lost pacifiers, and I just think of Oh, baby lost his binky. No wonder baby's cranky. I just like to imagine the myriad of people that are touched or affected by that one lost glove or that one lost pacifier.
Little stories told one post at a time. We also have a call from York, Maine. Anita, go ahead.
Hi, David. Tom, I wanted to congratulate you, Tom, for your short stories foray. I'm looking forward to reading that. I as well write, but a little bit differently, as a resume writer for over 30 years, telling people stories. So I'm really looking forward to reading that. I had a question in regards to about 10 years ago, the Dave Clark 5 speech, or induction speech at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I think it's a classic. And I was just wondering, were you a big fan growing up, and did they ask you, or did you ask them if you could introduce them there?
Thanks so much for the question, Anita.
That's
Tom, go ahead.
That's a lovely question. Thank you. I was convinced in probably March or April of 1964 that the Dave Clark Five were 10 times better than the Beatles. I'd seen them on the Ed Sullivan Show and Glad All Over, Bits and Pieces. A few songs just absolutely rocked my world. When I was promoting, much like on a worldwide press tour, the movie that I wrote called That Thing You Do, somebody said, I was in a round table in England, I said, "Why'd you make this movie?" "Well, I'll do make this movie." And I said to prove that the Dave Clark Five were better than the Beatles. And it was just a funny little joke. But then Dave Clark himself rang me up, and I was thrilled to hear from him. When they were inducted into the Hall of Fame, yes, David asked me if I would do the speech, and I took it very, very, very seriously. I wanted to capture just the joy and the possibility that he and his mates, and also everybody else that came over in February of 1964, just a few months after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And I had to here's an orator's little hint. If their induction was one of the last of the evening, and it was a late night in New York City, and people started heading home. And so I had to ramp up my delivery of what was pretty much a very impassioned speech anyway. So I raised the decibels a little bit in order to get everybody's attention and got a few people to sit back down till the end of the ceremony.
Yeah, obviously, Tom Hanks, you starred in Forrest Gump as a guy who shows up almost everywhere in history. I think of some of your biggest films, maybe not your biggest, but some of films that are very memorable. A lot of them are you're playing real life figures and heroes. Sully, Apollo 13, Band of Spies. In Saving Private Ryan, not, I don't think, based on a true person, but nonetheless playing somebody in a historical moment in World War II. One of the stories that you wrote, I believe it's called The Past is Important to Us, you alluded to earlier, and it's about a guy who comes home from World War II, and you sort of learn as the story unfolds how deeply injured and how deeply affected he was by what occurred in that war.
Dave, I need to just slightly correct you. You're talking about Christmas Eve 1953.
Oh,
That's all right. That's all right. This is live radio, so it all works.
This happens, man.
I know. The past is important to us is a story about a billionaire who can afford to take time travel vacations with a company called Chronometric Adventures. And he can only go back to one day in time based on the franchise of the company. And he goes back over and over again to 1939, the 1939 World's Fair. The first time he is taken there by his young fourth wife. But he keeps going back on his own in order to make an acquaintance with a woman that he saw out of the corner of his eye. And he goes back so many times that he loses the molecular ability to travel. So he makes one last trip to the World's Fair. Would you like me to read a little bit?
I actually did want you to read from that. So why don't you go ahead and then we can talk about the
other. Okay, here it is. He wakes up in a hotel room in New York City in 1939. As before, the double-breasted suit was hanging in the open closet with shoes and socks on the floor. On a thin wire hanger was a button shirt and tie. Undergarments were in a basket on a chair. On the nightstand were the watch, a wedding band, a signet ring, and the wallet that contained his ID and other items that were accurate for the period and made out of pre-World War II materials. There was cash, a total of $50 in the funny-looking paper currency that was once legal tender. There were heavy coins as well, a half dollar imprinted with a lady holding wheat looking toward the setting sun, and 10-cent pieces called dimes with the head of the god Mercury. Nickels were worth 5 cents, and single pennies had real value in 1939.
I love that because, of course, nickels are worth 5 cents still, and they don't really have any value in 2018,
no,
right?
I think you pretty much round up to the next 25 cents now, isn't that
more or less? Have a quarter, take a quarter. I love the specificity of this, but I also am interested in your fascination with sort of historical moments, like the World's Fair, and for that matter, like World War II. What got you interested in paying such close attention to these things?
I have always read history for pleasure. I've been doing it since I was, I think, 10 years old. Again, I come back to the human behavior at any one of the epochs in time, if I'm using the word epoch correctly. At any moment in time, throughout all of history, everybody who was alive that moment thinks they're on the cutting edge of something, that nothing is going to advance farther than where they are right now. In William Manchester's A World Lit Only by Fire, no one had really ever traveled more than perhaps 2 miles away from where they were born and where they died any number of years later, sometimes only 17 years later, sometimes more. And that sort of perspective has always struck me as almost cruel, that here we are, we think we know everything, but 2 days can go by and it's proven just how ignorant we are. Not only to the great possibilities that humankind can advance upon themselves, but also the constant remaking of the same mistakes based on what we want and how we want it and when we want it. The great quote of those who do not know history are doomed to repeat it. It comes back to a vanity of vanities, all is vanity, there is nothing new under the sun. And 1939, for example, the World's Fair, it was the world of tomorrow. It was going to be this magnificent, beautiful time of bounty in which technology and imagination and the desire for humankind to get along with each other was going to rule the day and bring about a world that was almost impossible to imagine. And yet it seemed to be right around the corner. And if you just add 10 years onto 1939 to 1949, look what mayhem had ensued between that World's Fair and the same month of June in 1949. The sad progression that we all have towards the future is one that's totally within our realm of altering, but we we just seem to only have like a 2% plus factor. It seems as though only 51% of the world moves forward, and that 49% either wants to stay where it is, protect the status quo, or actually goes backwards. And that's true for 1939, 1969, and 2019 as well. It's just the way of the world, and therefore I think history is always the most it's a subject matter that makes me slap my head more often than not because of what people went through and what they thought was possible, and then also what the actions that they took.
We have a call from Boston, Massachusetts. Dan, I think you have a question about some of the choices he makes in terms of his movies.
Yeah, hi. Hi, David. Love the show. And Tom, it's an absolute pleasure to be on the same air with you. I've been a big fan since I was a kid, and I'm a lot older than that now. I grew up with Bosom Buddies and Big and Turner and Hooch and all that. But so you kind of, it seemed like you started out your career with a lot of these comedic roles. And even though you've moved into somewhat more serious, dramatic roles, you still seem to find a way to kind of keep that little bits of like comedic undertones on in a lot of your roles, almost all of your roles. And I was just wondering if that's really natural for you, because it seems to come across that way on screen. So.
Hey, Dan, well, thanks so much for the call.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Dan. The making movies is all about capturing whatever reality is required right at that moment. And that comes into what human behavior is and what are the possibilities at that individual moment is. And, you know, goofy things happen. People are funny. Not everybody is, continuously driven in kind of one note. And maybe unless you're doing a Henrik Ibsen play, you know, maybe, or, you know, I find that life is more like Shaw than it is Ibsen. There's people that end up saying and doing witty things. And I think in a motion picture, I think the more that you can touch on. And by the way, I haven't done – I mean, if you see like my Robert Langdon movies, the Da Vinci Code films, I mean, those are just as serious as, a car chase. All we do is run around and with serious looks on our faces. But even then, there is a possibility in order to, to do some version of like twisting a knee or parking in the wrong place. And I think that is what brings a lot of the choices that I make in the motion pictures that I do into a realm of understanding for everybody. I mean, I think everybody can relate to the oddities and the varieties of just getting from one place to the other.
Tom, it seems to me you don't play very many. I can hardly think of any people or characters on screen that you can't some way find yourself in, some commonality, some sense of the notion of decency, even if in like Road to Perdition, it's not a particularly honorable profession that they pursued. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's really what my artistic bent is. It's what I look for in all art, be it a, painting. Or Shakespeare. I think human motivation.
You never really want to chew the scenery, scenery, and be a bad guy.
I've done that, David. Don't you need to read some more of my critical reviews? There's been times I've gone at it like that, but I don't believe any character necessarily that just wants to rule the world for the sake of ruling the world. I am drawn to stories all across the board, not just the ones that I create or my own, but in any motion picture that I see. I want to understand the motivations of everybody, including the bad guy. Because if they're just bad, well, then it's just the standard antagonist-protagonist dilemma. And it's very classic, and it's been done a million times before. And you hate the bad guy, and you love it when they die or get hurled off into space to come back for the sequel or whatever. But it's not as engaging, I think, as well. What is that going through? You know, the one of the role when I first started off as an actor, when I was doing Shakespeare in Cleveland at the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival, the role I really wanted to play more than any was Iago in Othello, which is one of the biggest parts in Shakespeare. And I wanted to do it because I felt as though I understood why Iago was so pissed off. He'd been passed over for a promotion. And that alone is enough for me in order to hang any sort of tragedy or any sort of story, how they take to it. My countenance, I think, is one of not necessarily sympathy, but I think of empathy for anybody who is going through something, you know, massive and tragic, even if they're just cowards. You know, that's a very legitimate thing to figure out when you're approaching a character. If they're a bad guy in a story, if they're a good guy in the story, so what drives this person? It can't just be a man's got to do what a man's got to do, unless you'll understand what that individual man has to do.
We're talking with a man who knows himself and whom we feel we know from his movies and now, of course, from his collection of short stories, Uncommon Type. Tom Hanks, stick around. We hope that you folks stick around. You can join our conversation. Do you identify with his characters? Which do you like best? What do you see in his writing or his performances? What would you like to ask him about how Hollywood really works? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal. For 20 years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has been making fun of the news with comedians and celebrity guests. We got silly limericks. We got terrible impressions. If you think the news is a joke, wait till you hear our show. New podcast episodes are available every Saturday.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, and joining us from NPR West in Culver City is Mr. Tom Hanks. You can join the conversation. What's your question for Tom Hanks? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. My guest this hour, I think I've mentioned, it's Tom Hanks. Tom, thanks for sticking with us here. You ask, we deliver. You said you wanted to talk to us about typewriters. Let's take a moment and talk about typewriters.
Oh,
all
dear.
Right?
Okay. All right.
You know, you seem to be a public radio kind of guy. Not only have you shown up shows, you seem to listen to it. You hosted Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me for us,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I have a wild collection of tote bags and coffee cups.
And yes. God bless you for it.
Yeah.
So here's what we're thinking of. You can do this one of two ways. We've got the sounds of three different typewriters.
Oh, the sounds. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
all
we
right.
can either – we got no video here for you.
Yeah,
no, we got sound here in public radio. So we can play each individually and you can – guess it, or we can tell you what the three typewriters are, and then you can listen and try to say which is.
Oh, do that. Give me one, two, and three. Tell me what they are. Like,
okay. So
tell me what typewriters you have.
Here's what we got. Three sounds we have are the 1922 Remington number 11 typewriter.
Oh, okay. 22. That'll be a very sharp clack of a report, I'm guessing.
Sharp
okay.
clack, the man guesses. The Hermes Rocket 1969.
A 69? Okay, that will have a very small throw. That's like an ultra portable typewriter, yeah.
And the IBM Selectric 3.
Oh, that'll be a bunt.
That'll be a bunt for the man.
Yeah.
All right, so let's line them up and play it down. Pick them, Tom.
Okay. That's the 1922 one.
Okay. Let's go on to the second. That's your right.
Oh, that's the Rocket, without a doubt.
And that's a 1969 Rocket. Go right ahead. Have we done this chronologically? We may have. Go right ahead. Play the third. There's your
bunt. That's the IBM. That's the IBM right there.
All right. So what do you like of those three? What do you like?
Which would I take?
Yeah.
Well, I think understand this about the IBM. The Selectrics were not actually typewriters. They applied a layer of tape onto a piece of paper as opposed to stamping ink into it. It's more like a version of offset printing. The Hermes rocket, what would be one of the greatest typewriters you would ever need, but it's awfully small, incredibly portable. I would want one earlier in the 60s than 1969, just because maybe you'd get a little more steel in the engineering.
Bigger frame, bigger chassis?
No, it's not so much that. It's mostly the materials itself. Hermes made two great portable typewriters, the Baby and the Rocket. And the Baby was really small. And the Rocket probably might have a little bit of a plastic casing to it by 1969. I'm not sure. So what did you say, it was a Royal from 1922? Or an Underwood?
No, it was not a Royal.
What was that, 1922?
Let me pull this back up.
It was a number 11.
It was a Remington number 11.
Remington. You would want that. Believe it or not, a Remington 11 made in 1922 will work exactly in 2018 as it worked in 1922. They were solid. They were built to last forever. A little gimcracky in the way they looked. But as you can tell from that report, that's a solid piece of engineering. That's like a big, massive steam engine that can still work absolutely perfectly. I'd say put that bad boy on your desk. Leave it covered so it doesn't collect too much dust. It would be very easy to adjust the margins and the tabs because they weren't hidden. They were right out there where everybody could discover to them. And Bob's your uncle.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard from the nation's typist laureate, Tom Hanks, on what to do and how to do it. At the front of your book, Uncommon Type, you dedicate it to your wife, the actor Rita Wilson, your kids, but also to Nora, which I assume is a reference to the screenwriter Nora Ephron. Why dedicate it to her?
Nora was one of the very – she was probably – I think she – I would have to say she was the first person who said, you know, you're a writer. Do you realize that? And I had written on – writing on screenplays is kind of like it's a version of writing, but you're actually just kind of like getting down kind of hints of a blueprint in order for somebody else to take and make malleable. But as far as writing prose, or really just coming up with the more detailed bones of structure of a story, when we were working on Sleepless in Seattle, I went on this – I was really cranky about something that had been in the pages that she and her sister Delia had written. And I went on this big, long tear of how they were wrong. I said, you guys are women. You're moms. You have moms that would be undone by their son disagreeing with you or not wanting you to go away for a weekend. You guys are nuts. I'm a man. I'm a dad. And I'm not about to let some 11-year-old kid of mine tell me I can't go off for a weekend and enjoy the company of a woman. And they said, both of them said, well, then let's do that. And then after that, they said, you know, when the movie came out, she said, you wrote that. I said, Nora, I didn't write that. I was just complaining. She says, no, you wrote it. You laid it out. And we put on down just what you had said. So all of my writing up to then, since then, I would give to her and I would give her a pass at it and tell her ask her, if this a thing and what should I do? And one time I wrote a piece that ended up in the New York Times about my makeup man, Danny Strepek, who had retired. And I sort of like did an homage to him and a bit of his life story and the relationship that he and I had over the better, I think about 15 films or 11 films. And I sent it to her and she said, yes, this is definitely a thing, but I have three notes for you. Voice, 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 she said. And that was, number one, a great acknowledgement from somebody I greatly admire who is investing in me, her opinion, and also giving me advice. And it was also just about the harshest to-do list a writer could ask for. She says, I see what you're trying to do, but you have no voice. Develop that voice and you'll have something there. So I think I became a writer with Nora's great aid and her charity.
I always think of Sleepless in Seattle, not only for movie, but as a moment of indulgence. It was my introduction to the Baltimore Sun, and I went on to work there for over a decade, not long after.
You see how cinema can touch everybody's lives.
Well, it certainly makes you remember things. Things stick with you a couple decades later. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the movie business. You've talked a bit about this over the course of the last year or so. Obviously, the Me Too moment is a national issue, and yet it really seems to have affected Hollywood. You know, how has it changed how you've gone about what you do as a producer and as an actor there?
Well, it has steamrolled the entire country because everything has changed. The rules are different. There is now, I think, a brand of codified behavior that everybody understands, must understand, is the only way to do business professionally. Look, there are certainly people who are going to be idiots, and there's going to be people who are jerks, and there's also going to be people who are very sensitive to the farther outreach, what it means to come into work every single day, whether you work in a bank or whether you work at a studio or you're working on a movie set. In one way, we're all part of this grand carnival that we all left town in order to join the circus because it's fun and it's a great hang, and we'd probably be doing it for nothing anyway. But along with that now comes, without a doubt, a very, very... it's both extremely well-defined and at the same time malleable, because at any given moment, human behavior can enter the fray. The Me Too movement means it's 100% a two-way street, 100% equity, and there is behavior that not only will no longer be tolerated, but it's also behavior that has been running rampant for far too long. This is no longer the days of an old studios where sexual escapades are sometimes, you know, noted when you look at the previews to movies on Turner Classic Films about who was having an affair and who was in love with whom. That is one aspect of the grand Hollywood saga. But this is now a place where all of society, and in fact, the world, is going to have to come to terms with what is acceptable professional behavior and personal responsibility.
So the same events no longer seen as escapades at all, but as
well, it's a multi-sex locker room now, and there's stuff that simply you can't say and you can't do because it's not right.
And do you find that's changed, you know, as you work through Playtone as a producer, you saying, look, we're going to pay stars perfectly equally, even if one can draw more box office? It sounds like there's some complicated implications here.
Well, that is actually the other side of it. I think that there must be some degree of parity. Now, people are in different places along the food chain, without a doubt, and there are places that are different people who are different places in your career. But it has to be a shared equity, and that equity has to be 50-50.
We have an email from a listener, from Barbara, saying, I remember watching Bosom Buddies on TV and thinking, wow, who's this guy? He's so funny. Can you remember a time where you had that thought about someone else? Who is this? I need to work with them.
Oh, my Lord.
Give us a take.
Name it. It goes on and on. I will tell you I've now made... Oh, I think I've made 5 movies with Steven Spielberg. If you had told me that I would have worked with Steven Spielberg when I was eating popcorn at the Sacramento Cinema seeing Close Encounters of the Third Kind for the first time, I would have said you're nuts. So there was without a doubt a pinch me version of this, because the desire just to do good work and just be part of something like what they do is extraordinary. Of late, working with Paul Greengrass on Captain Phillips, that was based on he made 2 of the most impressive movies I've ever seen. One was called Bloody Sunday and the other one was United 93. Both films were incredibly uncomfortable about very, very unpleasant subjects, but he brought an authenticity and an omnipotence to the experience that I don't know how filmmakers necessarily approach that like that. Then you have a long string of people that you get to work with. I'm working now. I'm going to be doing a film called You Are My Friend with the director Mari Heller, who directed this movie that knocked me out called Diary of a 13-Year-Old Girl, and Matthew Reese, who just won an Emmy for his work in The Americans, and he played Daniel Ellsberg in The Post, and he's in the film as well. So it's a never-ending pinch me moment where you get a chance to work with someone you greatly admire, and then you just hope that they're your pleasant company for them in the course of the hang.
That next project about Mr. Rogers, if I'm not mistaken, a memorable, another real life character, a man of decency.
Yeah, I got to start playing makeup guys, man.
But they're all going to end up being incredibly, pressed in extraordinary circumstances they didn't predict, right? Ultimately, they'll be really decent guys who perform in the moment.
Well, is it
as a makeup guy?
That's all of us. All of us, I know that you put forward the idea of ordinary people that are in extraordinary circumstances. All of us are ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. Some of us are trained, some of us want to be Navy SEALs and we have the body for it. Others of us are orthodontists and are fascinated by teeth. But all of us are people that at some point or another have something come across their desk or into their lives that make you wonder, how am I going to deal with this? What did I do in order to deserve this? I think I get some sort of credit or weight thrown my way because I look the way I look and I sound the way I sound and I have this nose and this hair. And so I don't necessarily maybe look the part of what people who achieve or survive extraordinary moments do. But all of us in some way or another are just people who just loved doing something, like Chesley Sullenberger, Sully. He just loved to fly, and he took his job seriously. And if he had not landed that plane on the Hudson River, he would just be nothing more than a retired airline pilot, an ordinary retired airline pilot. But instead, he's Sully. So all of us have these moments of greatness that are required of us. The writer Alan First, who I've read almost everything that he's
Thank
written.
God, finally get to talk to someone about Alan First. I love that guy.
He writes about espionage and the world prior to the Nazi defeat in Stalingrad. And someone asked him, I heard him on NPR. And he said, why do you write about this one individual period? And he said, because up to that point, no one thought the Nazis were going to lose World War II. They had not been stopped yet. And so everybody who was in that arena at that time had a choice of being one of three things that was determined by their character and their circumstances. They could either be a hero, or they could be a villain, or they could be a coward. That's the three choices you had at that time. And I think, oh, my Lord, so often that is exactly what life prescribes for all of us. What are we going to choose to be? What do we have the wherewithal to be? What do we have the stomach for, or the training, or the desire? What's our initial instinct to run, to flee, or to lean in, get involved, or just to stand back and watch? That's that pretty much wraps up every circumstance a human being can find themselves in.
Before today, I would say I've spoken about the spy thrillers, the World War II settings with two of my best friends from high school. One, true story, one named Charles, one named Darwin. Today, I've done so with Tom Hanks, the actor, director, producer, and he's the author of Uncommon Type. Tom Hanks, such a treat. Thanks for joining me today.
David, I really enjoyed it. Thanks very much. Thanks for the calls, everybody.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hartzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Kyrie Thompson, and Miriam Wasser. With help from Madeline D'Angelo and Lexi Puri, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.